Part 3. Glory. Chapter 9. True or False? Einstein always believed that there was an invisible framework to our universe, waiting to be found. He had always suspected, moreover, that this cosmic architecture would be very simple and very exact and very clear. And what could be simpler or more exact or clearer than an idea like G equals T? It seemed impossible that his theory about space and gravitation could be false. In the immediate wake of his breakthrough in November 1915, Einstein showed no hint of self-doubt, yet he knew that others had doubted him before. His earliest ideas about gravity, dating back to his thoughts in the patent office in 1907, had had only a limited impact. Even his initial elaborations during his Prague years had remained largely a private matter. But as Einstein's recognition among physicists had grown, resistance to his work in this area had grown as well. When he'd presented his extended theoretical elaborations at a conference in Vienna in 1913, seemingly the whole audience of distinguished faculty members had claimed that he must be deluded. At the time, Einstein had tried to stay calm, but later he admitted how shaken he had been. "My colleagues concerned themselves with my theory," he remembered, "only with the intention of killing it dead." Even Max Planck, then Europe's most respected scientist, had had doubts, writing to Einstein, "As an older friend, I must advise against publicizing this new theory. You won't succeed, and no one will believe you." Einstein knew he needed to convince his colleagues that his theory was legitimate, but perhaps most of all, he needed to reassure himself. Newton's theory of gravitation had been the bedrock of scientific thought for centuries. There was nothing in it about warped space. To one of his closest confidants, the Dutch theoretician Hendrik Lorentz, whom Einstein revered almost as a father figure, he admitted, "My business still has so many major hitches that my confidence fluctuates." Einstein was still fairly young and had only recently received professional esteem. What he was attempting with G equals T was terrifyingly bold. In essence, he was telling his colleagues that, like the inhabitants of Flatland, they had been blind to the fact that they existed within a higher dimension that they could not see. Now he claimed to have discovered it. No wonder they were sceptical. What Einstein really needed was a test, some way of confirming the existence of this higher dimension around us. But how to pull out a test from something as seemingly abstract as the relation G equals T? He already had one possible way of proving his theory correct. He had been able to show, on the basis of his new equation, that the planet Mercury would advance in a fashion ever so slightly different from what Newton had predicted. The problem was that this wasn't really news. Astronomers had already recognized that Mercury orbited differently than those predictions. Although no one, apart from Einstein, had been able to explain why this might be the case, cynical observers could always say that Einstein had started with those known facts about the orbit and worked backwards to create a theory that would produce such an orbit. What would be far more impressive would be if he could show that his new theory predicted something that nobody had imagined could possibly occur, and then go ahead, test that prediction, and show it was true. As early as his time in Prague in 1912, Einstein had thought about this, and now he realized there might be a way to pull it off. Remember the ball bearing flicked forward on the taut trampoline? When it travelled where the trampoline was flat, it rolled forward in a quick, straight line. When it got close to the sag at the centre of the trampoline, where a small rock was bending it down, a rock that represented our sun, then the ball bearing veered inward as it dipped along that sag. Our sun is so massive that it produces a huge sag in space around it, and this is what the Earth glides along, like a ball caught in a roulette wheel, with only the earlier forward motion preventing it from rolling even farther towards the sun. In thinking about how to test his theory of gravitation, Einstein realized that according to his theory, it wasn't just the planets that would be pulled along by space's curvature in this way. Light, too, would be bent by gravity. At first glance, that seems impossible. We're taught that if you shine a flashlight beam from one manned balloon to another, it shouldn't matter whether the balloons are high over the empty Pacific Ocean or whether they're floating right beside Mount Everest. The flashlight beam is going to travel in a straight line. It's not going to be tugged sideways simply because a massive mountain is beside it. But the belief that light only travels in straight lines is a delusion, simply based on the fact that we live on a planet with weak gravity, or so Einstein suspected. If we could peer at realms where gravity was much stronger than it is on Earth, we should, in fact, be able to detect invisible gullies opening up in space by seeing light swerve as it hurries along. A variation of Einstein's simplest thought experiment shows how he arrived at this hypothesis. Instead of having a drugged explorer waking up, floating freely in a closed room, imagine that you're the victim. And this time, instead of floating weightlessly, you feel a comfortable force pulling you down to the floor. Like the explorer's flotation, this force too is ambiguous. It could mean you've safely landed on the ground on Earth, your terrifying journey is over, and when the airlock opens, you'll get to step outside to a waiting, applauding crowd. But it also could mean that you are in a room out in space, one that has been hijacked by merciless marauders who've attached a hook and are now tugging you forward to their evil mothership. If their acceleration is calibrated right, you'll be pressed down to the floor with exactly the same intensity, no more, no less, than someone would feel in an elevator car waiting calmly for the door to open on the ground floor on Earth. This is an effect we recognise when we're in a car that suddenly accelerates and we get pushed back against the seat. Close your eyes, ignore the roar of the engine, and you could be on a planet whose gravitational pull is tugging you into the seat just as hard. Suppose you're in the second scenario of Einstein's thought experiment, a hijacked accelerating room, not a room resting on Earth, and you manage to find a window, perhaps by lifting up a metal plate that had covered it. And suppose that, as you do so, the beam from a lighthouse on a convenient exuberant planet shines brightly into your window. If you weren't moving, you'd see the light beam come into the room and hit against the far wall, exactly opposite the window where it entered. But since your kidnappers are accelerating your own vessel upwards, the light will not fall in exactly the same place it would if you were motionlessly suspended in space. Rather, in the time it takes for the light beam to move across your room, your vessel will have moved up a little, so that when the beam of light hits the far wall, it won't be exactly opposite the window where it came in, but instead will have curved to hit a little bit lower down. The second part of the thought experiment reflects one of Einstein's driving views, what might be called observational democracy, the belief that just as no one automatically deserves superior rights in life, so no one observer can say that their vantage point in viewing some event is automatically superior to that of everyone else's. In the thought experiment at hand, what this means is that no one can possibly tell if they're being tugged in distant space or if they're standing still in a closed room on Earth, not if the tug pulling them along is of the right intensity. What someone sees inside one of those rooms will have to be exactly what they'd see if they were in the other one. To see how this would hold true in the thought experiment, imagine how seeing the lighthouse from a stationary room on Earth might compare to seeing the lighthouse from a hijacked room in space. In the tugged room, where you're held down to the floor with the force of 1G, because the evil pirates are tugging you along, light bends as it travels across the room. In the static room on Earth, where you're also held down to the floor with the force of 1G, because the Earth produces real gravity, light will also have to bend as it travels across the room. Why? Because if the light bending wasn't the same, you'd be able to tell the difference between the two places, and that's what we've agreed is impossible. From this simple thought experiment, Einstein deduced that light bends in a gravitational field just as it would if viewed from an accelerating position. And that was the sort of prediction he could test. The rough approach had been in his mind early in his long years of work leading up to general relativity, although the details only became properly refined as he reached the final theory in 1915. The real-life experiment Einstein envisioned was also simple, at least in scientific terms. He just needed to find a vastly ponderous mass, one bulky enough to create a huge sag in space near it, and then see if speeding light beams in fact veered off course as they passed close by, like the high-speed race car banking hard as it follows a curve. By observing the light beams that were visible around the periphery of such a massive object, Einstein predicted, one should be able to see what was behind it, all because the curvature of space caused by gravity would redirect the light from the hidden object to the observer's eyes. In our solar system, Einstein realized, there was only one suitable candidate for such a test, the Sun. It is so massive and should bend space so significantly that it should have a noticeable effect on the light around it. But there was one problem with this idea. Even if the Sun did cause light near it to curve, Einstein knew, most of the time this would be too hard to detect. The effect would be quite small, just a fraction of a degree. During the day, when we can see the Sun, its flames and explosions are so bright that they make it impossible to see the distant starlight that might be whipping close beside it. But during a total eclipse? Then the best of both worlds combine. The sky is dark, but the Sun is right overhead. Distant starlight that arrived in line with its edge would suddenly be visible. If that light had been bending, we would be able to see it. Einstein had conceived of this test when he was first trying to elaborate the relationship between G and T, which he would finally pinpoint in his November 1915 breakthrough. But there was a reason he had been unable to report the results of such a test when he formally presented his theory of general relativity, with G equals T at its core, to Germany's greatest scientists late that year. Einstein had been entrusting the tests to an eager young astronomer named Erwin Freundlich, who had impressed him with his knowledge and keenness to help, and whose surname appropriately is German for friendly. But Freundlich turned out to be a man of stunning, probability-busting bad luck. Freundlich's first suggestion to Einstein had been not to wait for an eclipse at all, but to go through old photographic plates stored at the Hamburg Observatory to see if those had inadvertently captured eclipses under the conditions Einstein required. Einstein wrote back with his support for the idea. Freundlich got permission from the observatory's director, started scanning and measuring plates, and found that although there were many, very many plates in the observatory's archives, astronomers had repeatedly just missed recording the starlight deflections that would prove Einstein's theory true and win Freundlich respect and fame. Freundlich was ever optimistic. Why not see if one could perhaps glimpse distant stars during the day and use measurements taken that way rather than wait for an eclipse to darken the daytime sky? This was such an exciting idea that in 1913 he made a special trip to Zurich to talk it over with his new friend Einstein. Unfortunately, it was also Freundlich's honeymoon, which meant that his new wife had to sit politely while her husband attended a lecture on relativity, then as they shared lunch with Einstein, and finally as they all went for a long walk after lunch. One imagines that, for her, it was a very long day. Later, in the weeks after Freundlich left, Einstein did some checking. It was obvious, he found, that the glare was just too strong, and that no telescope, not even the great instruments on Mount Wilson in California, a letter from its director confirmed, would be able to carry out the procedure Freundlich had proposed. Freundlich's next idea seemed better. There was a total solar eclipse coming up in August 1914, roughly a year off, and it would be visible not too far away, in the beautiful Crimea of southern Russia, near the sophisticated port city of Sebastopol. The Imperial Russian Battle Fleet had its headquarters there, which meant there would be restaurants and fine hotels nearby, where he could celebrate when the imaging was done. At that time, Germany and Russia had been at peace for many years, so there was no reason to think anything could go wrong. Freundlich's enthusiasm to confirm Einstein's initial ideas grated on some of the older researchers who constituted the astronomical establishment in Germany, and the official funding bodies resisted giving as much money as would be needed. Einstein couldn't believe how little belief they had in Freundlich. There wasn't much time to prepare. Before 1913 was out, he wrote Freundlich, "If the Academy won't play ball, then we'll get that little bit of cash from private quarters. If everything fails, I'll pay for the thing out of my own slight savings. But go ahead and order the plates. Don't let time slip by because of the money question." Even with Einstein's help, there was a shortfall, but Freundlich managed to secure extra funds from the immensely wealthy Krupp family, the world-terrifying arms merchants. The Krupps' cannons and other military equipment were sold around the world, and they were the backbone of the German army. Towards the end of July 1914, Erwin Freundlich arrived in the Russian peninsula of the Crimea. A few days later, World War I began. Germany and Russia were on opposite sides. Freundlich was by then camping in the wilderness, outfitted with exceptionally powerful telescopes, not far from the headquarters of Russia's Imperial Battle Fleet. It's hard to imagine how one could make a German national seem more suspicious, especially as all his documentation showed that the Krupp Foundation was behind his mission. Freundlich's party was quickly surrounded by armed Russians, and his beautiful, lovingly prepared equipment was confiscated. When the eclipse took place, as predicted, on August the 21st, the surrounding stars serenely distanced from the furious cannon flashes all over Europe, Freundlich was in a Russian prison camp. Einstein and others managed to get Freundlich out of lockup as part of a prisoner exchange not too much later. Characteristically, Freundlich wasn't downhearted. He simply had to engineer more opportunities to find fresh proof. The next really good solar eclipse wouldn't be for several years, which was too long to wait. But what if, instead of being so fixated on the sun, they thought of measuring starlight falling into one of the invisible gravity valleys that had to exist near the planet Jupiter? The deflection would be smaller than from starlight falling into the big curves in space near our sun, just as small pebbles on a trampoline surface make it sag less than heavier stones do. But Jupiter was certainly easier to photograph than the sun. It wasn't a terrible idea, but by the time Freundlich began racing to get the right equipment together, his Hamburg observatory director had had enough of this underling's exuberance. Einstein wrote to the Ministry of Education, encouraging administrators to bypass any bureaucrats who got in the way and give support to Freundlich. The minister passed the request on to the observatory director, who was not just a professor, but a privy councillor, who prided himself on being addressed by the title Geheimrat, or, in a pinch, Your Excellency. He certainly didn't think of himself as a bureaucrat to be bypassed, and in his estimation Freundlich was a mere junior of questionable competence and unacceptable insubordination. The director wrote a firm and barbed response to Einstein. Even the multitude of the most sophisticated measurements by expert observers, let alone by those who do not come under this heading, will not yield any useful results and merely cause a needless expenditure of time and effort. The obstruction from Freundlich's boss was only one of the problems. As the war dragged on and Britain's naval blockade of Germany hardened, it proved impossible for Einstein and the loyal Freundlich to carry out their astronomical test. Einstein's bold new theory, it seemed, was dead in the water. That is, unless there was someone else to whom he could turn for help.